Welcome to Oncology Decoded. We're going to do something special for you guys today. And I know this is dropping in your feed right after GU ASCO, but we're not talking about GU medical oncology today. We are going to talk about GI medical oncology. And it's our fault for being a little bit late. That's because we don't know what we're doing when we talk about GI. And that's why we have some very special guests who do. So, Manoj, are you excited to talk about GI today?
I'm super excited. I think this is going to be a learning experience for you and I, because it's not something that we do on a day-to-day basis. Hopefully, we'll be able to help her.
Hear that enthusiasm. It's palpable. He loves GI medical oncology. Okay. Well,
my specialty was actually in GI.
Oh, well, there you go.
My advanced fellowship was in GI.
We turned him into a GU medical oncologist. So I can say I'm proud of that. I'll take full responsibility of that. All right. But anyways, with us today are two of my colleagues and close friends who actually did fellowship training with me at MD Anderson years ago. So with that, we have Meredith Pelster, the Associate Director of GI Medical Oncology for Sarah Cannon Research Institute. And I also have Dr. Jason Henry, who practices in Denver, and he's the Associate Director of Drug Development out there for the SCRI unit out there. So we have Jason Henry from Denver. We have Meredith Pelster, who's only two doors down. She can probably hear my loud voice booming down the hallway right now because our walls are paper thin. And then, of course, you all know Dr. Manoj Bhupathi, who's also in Denver at RMCC. So, Jason, Meredith, can we use first names? Are we excited today?
Oh, very.
Yeah.
Thanks, Ben. Very excited.
Jason, I heard from Meredith. This is our first podcast. Jason, is this your first podcast?
Yeah, I was on a travel podcast years ago for my wife, but from an oncology perspective, this is my first podcast.
Very exciting. Very exciting. Well, Oncology Decoded is glad to have you. And, you know, as listeners on this podcast know, we do mostly GU medical oncology research on this podcast. However, we're going to start to do what we've been doing, which we hope has been successful if you're listening to this podcast, and try to start translating it into fields outside of GU. We had a special episode, if you haven't heard it, about how is oncology done in India, right? And we had a really special guest. Please go back to the podcast feed and listen to that if you haven't heard it. And now we're going to dive back into ASCO GI. So with that, there was a lot of interesting information. I saw emails. I heard data dumps, all sorts of things about ASCO GI. And I just want to throw it out there. Whoever wants to grab the ball first, what do you think was the most impactful or interesting abstract that was presented at the ASCO GI conference in San Francisco last month?
Well, Jason,
biased.
Yeah, we are biased. Jason and I both do a lot of early drug development in our practices. And so we chatted a bit about our kind of the things we found most interesting from the conference. And we settled on the data on the mutant selective KRAS G12D inhibitor from Incyte in pancreas cancer. And Jason was actually the second author and I believe leading enroller on the study, so has a lot of direct experience. But we think that this is a really, really important study. It's not practice changing yet, as we'll get into, but as we'll talk about with the onslaught of RAS-directed therapies, we're likely to see a major change in the treatment of pancreatic cancer in the near future.
Okay. Can you walk us through what... Wow. So before we get there, can you walk us through what the trial is? Who are these patients? Just to kind of give us a very high level of just kind of level set and understand where we are. Because as you know, Ben and I know nothing about this, so we're just trying to understand how do we approach this pancreatic cancer patient, or what does this mean? How often are we testing? What does it all look like?
Yeah, I can get into that, Manoj. So looking at the 40,000 foot view, there's been very little progress in pancreatic cancer for 40 years. So there's been small changes with the addition of different chemotherapies, addition for olaparib for patients with BRCA mutant disease. But for the most part, changes have been incredibly marginal. Actually, during our fellowship, 2015, 16, 17, and then leading into our fellowship, Amgen and Mirati discovered the first KRAS inhibitor that actually demonstrated efficacy for patients with KRAS mutant disease, ultimately led to FDA approval in lung cancer and then subsequently colon. What that really did is open up the floodgates for other allele-specific inhibitors and pan-RAS inhibitors, which we can get in separately.
And Jason,
90%
confirmed. Yeah. Sorry, KRAS G12C for those previous molecules, and now we're talking about KRAS G12D. Correct.
That's right.
Okay. All right. So keep going. Keep teaching me. I just want to make sure I got it right.
Yeah. So KRAS G12C opened the floodgates for other allele-specific inhibitors. G12C is rarely mutated in GI cancers. It's about 1% in pancreatic cancer, a little bit higher in colon cancer. So I think it's exciting. You saw responses with those inhibitors in GI cancers for the first time ever, but still didn't impact an average patient that you'd see on a clinic and day to day. But it's led to a flurry of research for other more common alleles such as G12D, which we're going to be talking about today. This study, the Insight INCB161734, was a pretty standard dose escalation and expansion, both as a single agent in combination with chemotherapy. It is an on-off inhibitor in patients who are heavily pretreated. The exciting part was response rates were incredibly high, nearing 40%, I think documented in the study as 37%, and looks tolerable in combination with chemotherapy, although the numbers are incredibly small. From a patient and oncology perspective, this is exciting because G12D is the most common subtype affecting, somewhere around 40% of pancreatic cancer patients. The response rates, and I think this will ultimately translate to FS and hopefully OS, but certainly quality of life in my experience. 40% of patients, you get FOLFIRINOX, you get gemcitabine and Abraxane, and then there's nothing. Now we have a drug from Insight that demonstrates a 40% response rate, which exceeds that of chemo, certainly in the second line, and compares somewhat favorably with chemo in the first line. So you have an active drug that's well tolerated, that affects a large degree of patients. And I'd be surprised if these ultimately don't go to earlier line studies and make their way to community oncologists and demonstrate a meaningful step forward.
So I guess the question that I have, that was a really good rundown. Thanks, Jason. And maybe I'll throw it at Meredith. So you have a patient in clinic, pancreatic cancer, you order your NGS, you're about to start frontline therapy, KRAS G12D. Does it influence what you do now? I think the answer is probably not. But when do we expect that this may influence what you do?
Great question. So honestly, at this moment for a frontline patient, it doesn't impact what you do with as far as standard of care treatment unless you have access to a frontline trial. And these are coming. In fact, the Dawn 303 study is going to be Insight's frontline trial with this molecule. Great study design, choice of chemo backbone, gemnab or FOLFIRINOX plus minus drug. So great study. If you have that or one of the many other frontline RAS inhibitor pancreatic trials coming, then absolutely consider that for your patient. There has not, unless you were looking for a trial, there has not been a great reason to sequence pancreas cancer patients other than BRCA because of the lack of targeted therapies, but that is coming. So if you have access to trials, absolutely sequence your patients at diagnosis so that you can get them to a trial if appropriate. Most of the studies will accept tissue-based, and pancreas patients we know get sick fast. You can do a liquid biopsy, get that back in a week, and start on study enrollment. That's a great option.
So kind of this, I'm going to say a dumb question because I don't really know the answer to this, but for when we think about clonal evolution in markers, right? So we know that across tumor types, we can see that that changes, right? Like, I can relate to prostate cancer a lot, and we see this as the malignancy becomes more resistant, you'll see this evolution. Is that the same for KRAS? So when you see a KRAS, if you don't see it up front, do you at any point, do you see it later? Or is this one of those things where if you didn't see it the first time, you're probably not going to see it again?
Oh man, great question. Jason, interrupt me, but I'll take a first stab at this. So as Jason was alluding to, KRAS is the driver mutation in pancreas cancer. 90%+ of patients have some type of KRAS mutation. G12D is the most common, also associated with the worst prognosis. But some sort of KRAS mutation is going to be present in the vast, vast majority of your pancreatic cancer patients. The cancer is dependent on the overactivated pathway. So if you don't see a RAS mutation, you should question, like, did the test pick it up? So frequently on liquid biopsies, for example, if I get one back that says, RAS wild type, I'm going to be looking at that tumor fraction. Do I really trust the answer to that test and then go back and get a tissue? That is how central KRAS mutations are in pancreatic cancer. So the mutation should be there at the beginning. It's not something that develops over the course of the disease. But as we are getting more RAS-directed therapies in trials, we are starting to learn about resistance mechanisms to those therapies, where we do start to see things like KRAS amplifications, et cetera, as resistance mechanisms. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, it's very helpful. We kind of like the AR amplification or mutation. Maybe I can put it that way. Wind sugar rebound.
Yeah, I just learned something, right? I didn't realize nearly 100% of patients with pancreatic cancer and KRAS mutations. We occasionally get them popping up in urothelial carcinoma and some of the other tumor types that we work with more closely. But I think that that's instrumental. So I think what's the takeaway for this is we have KRAS drugs coming. They're already moving into late phase development. They'll eventually, seems like, get their way into an FDA approval. So in order to prepare for that, we need to be sequencing everyone with pancreatic cancer now, not just those germline, is this a heritable, or if I'm pronouncing that correctly, hereditary BRCA-based pancreatic cancer, or is what type of KRAS mutation, which I imagine is a somatic mutation that's not germline. Is that correct? I'm seeing a nodding yes. So we need to start looking for those now. So if you are in clinic with pancreatic cancer patients, make sure you have sequenced them, I think is a good takeaway. So that one, we can refer them to a place that does have a trial if there's a trial available after that frontline therapy, or two, so that you're ready and prepared when that trial or when that FDA approval comes for your patient in clinic. So I think that's, probably a big takeaway.
And just to reiterate, sorry to step in, Manoj, Insight, I think, has the most comprehensive data set to date, at least for a G12D, but there's others out there. I mean, in the G12D space, you have drugs from Loxo and Quanta and Revolution Medicines, of course, and many, many others. But in the field as a whole, Revolution Medicines, RMC-6236, which is a pan-RAS inhibitor and applies to all patients with RAS mutations, has already completed enrollment in their early line clinical trials. And many of us expect approval sometime this year, maybe as early as this summer. So if you think about it from a patient perspective, if you're meeting a new patient in March and you get them going on chemotherapy, there may already be FDA approved drugs by the time they're ready for second line therapy. The second point is in pancreatic cancer, KRAS isn't the only mutation that is targetable, at least from an investigational standpoint. I'll have Meredith chime in, but I'm just as excited about the MTAP inhibitors. PRMT5 cooperative inhibitors are showing similar efficacy and similar tolerability and are also actively enrolling in early line clinical trials. So a number of reasons to sequence your patient.
Absolutely. And we talked about with Insight this allele selective KRAS G12D inhibitor. Jason referenced daraxonrasib RMC-6236. That's a pan RAS inhibitor. I think that gives a good opportunity to talk about all the different types of drugs that we're seeing in this space because they are different. So if you think about the RAS family of proteins, you have KRAS, HRAS, NRAS. Most pancreas patients are going to have a KRAS mutation, D being the most common, V second, and then there are others, but there are some Q61, et cetera. So when you think about drug design, you could go as broad as possible, a pan-RAS inhibitor, hit everything, HRAS, NRAS, KRAS, wild type, all the mutations. That is daraxonrasib, which is the drug that is currently in a second line phase 3 trial expected to read out. Then we have pan-KRAS drugs. So these will hit most of the KRAS mutant alleles. And then you have mutant selective or allele specific inhibitors, mostly for G12D is what we've seen, but there are some coming for G12V. So, and as you can expect, sort of the toxicity profile changes as you go from broad to narrow. But when you start seeing these coming up in your clinic and your trial menus, there are some differences in drug design and mechanism of how these agents work.
Exciting time for pancreatic cancer. It seems like, you know, the days of chemotherapy don't seem that, you know, hopefully will go away as we saw it in urothelial cancer for first line therapy. I'm curious to know though, you know, when I was writing for first line pancreatic cancer a long time ago for either FOLFIRINOX or gemcitabine, toxicity can be quite challenging for that group of patients. How does the toxicity of these new drugs compare to systemic chemotherapy? Is it easier or unusual side effects that we need to monitor for, especially in the era of these targeted therapies? You know, I'm going to relate to bladder cancer, right? So we use targeted drugs like erdafitinib, but we have to worry about ocular toxicity. So are there like specific nuances that you think about as this is becoming more revolutionary in the treatment of pancreatic cancer?
I think for mutant-specific inhibitors, there are some subtleties between drugs, but for the most part, there's oral small molecule inhibitors, and the toxicity is pretty consistent, and it's primarily GI side effects, so things like nausea, vomiting, or diarrhea. Depending on the drug, you can see some, you know, more rare side effects such as liver toxicity and occasionally neuropathy or issues with blood counts. But for the most part, with these oral small molecule drugs, it's GI. And I personally find them very easy to manage. And I think when you talk to patients, a majority of patients say this is nothing compared to being on chemotherapy, which is one of the reasons we get excited.
And my key takeaways, and Ben, you can add on to this, of course, is test early. Exciting development for MTAP as well as KRAS and PAMRAS inhibitors, and tolerability seems to be much more favorable.
Yeah, I think that's it. I mean, we might have an FDA approval coming this year, it sounds like. So start testing now so you're ready to go, right? You don't want to be behind. We know that refractory pancreatic cancer can get nasty fast. So I think it's like that chess player. You want to be thinking a couple moves ahead. So I think this is really exciting. I think that's great. And I think it's time to shift over from KRAS and MTAP in pancreatic cancer and start talking about HER2 in colorectal cancer. So I know that a lot of you listening probably have a lot of colorectal patients if you're a community medical oncologist. Unfortunately, it's all too common, a disease process. So I think now we're going to learn about molecularly targeted upfront strategies, if I'm correct. So, you know, Meredith, you want to give us a rundown on Breakwater?
Yeah, absolutely. So Breakwater is looking at bringing BRAF V600E targeted therapy into the frontline setting for colorectal cancer patients. And as background, we've already had one part or a couple parts actually of Breakwater presented at prior conferences. And at GI ASCO, we were looking at a different backbone. But just to give you guys the full story, so over the course of 2025, we got some endpoints from Breakwater looking at FOLFOX with encorafenib and cetuximab versus standard frontline chemotherapy. Really, really interesting study design, kind of in partnership with the FDA as part of Project FrontRunner to get targeted therapies that have known activity in later line settings into the frontline. So the design for Breakwater, as I mentioned, was chemo backbone with the targeted therapy encorafenib and cetuximab versus the chemo control. It had dual primary endpoints. The first as overall response rate. So an early, quick endpoint that you get a readout on. And so kind of the agreement was, if we get an overall response rate signal, get accelerated approval, and then we await the PFS and OS that are going to come later. So over the course of 2025, first at GI ASCO, we got a FOLFOX, Inco Cetux, positive overall response rate endpoint. And then at Big ASCO, we got the overall survival data with that chemo combination versus control, which was dramatic. A doubling of overall survival in a patient population that has had historically quite poor outcomes. So that led to it being clearly the standard of care to incorporate encorafenib and an anti-EGFR monoclonal antibody with chemotherapy in that frontline setting. And what we learned at GI ASCO this year is that you can also do this with FOLFIRI as your backbone. So this was a smaller component of the study, but essentially same design, FOLFIRI with encorafenib and cetuximab versus chemotherapy alone control, significantly improved response rate, 64% versus 39%. Overall survival data, not mature yet, but a clear separation. So now we have the option of also using this as a backbone.
Now, I have two questions that immediately follow, and now I'm the one that's going to look silly, right? So encorafenib is a BRAF inhibitor, is that correct? Is it specific to the V600E mutation? Okay. I thought that generally these were given with another drug, like Incobeni, right? So why am I only hearing about one of them in combination with cetuximab and traditional chemotherapy with colorectal cancer?
Yeah, I'll take this one. I view BRAF as the OG of drug development when it comes to GI cancers, and we have much more experience in targeting the MAP kinase pathway. If you look from a historical perspective, when we used single agent BRAF inhibition in late line colorectal cancer, much like we're doing with KRAS inhibitors now, your response rates were in oftentimes the single digits. I think the reason for that, and this is colorectal specific, is you get rapid pathway feedback reactivation of EGFR. So that prompted the addition of cetuximab, which, you know, significantly improved responses and then ultimately translated to PFS and overall survival. What you're referring to, Ben, is actually the Beacon study, which investigated the doublet of encorafenib plus cetuximab versus encorafenib, binimetinib, and cetuximab versus chemotherapy, which was the second line study. I think the short answer to it is the triplet didn't improve outcomes. It added toxicity, but did not improve overall survival for the most part. And so going forward, investigators decided, well, you know, maybe we get a few more responses here and there, but we're not actually helping people live longer or live better. And so committed to the doublet of encorafenib and cetuximab.
So am I correct then? It sounds like in melanoma, you have to combine a MEK inhibitor with a BRAF inhibitor to overcome some of those resistances, as well as, you know, some of the toxicity management. But in colorectal, you're actually getting some of that resistance pathway is what you're targeting with the cetuximab in this case. And so that's why you can give the single agent BRAF inhibitor in combination with the drug we know has activity in colorectal cancer, but also happens to be nice in the sense that some of the resistance to the BRAF actually can be overcome through that as well. Am I reading that correctly?
Yeah, I think one important quick distinction is if you were to give cetuximab to a patient with BRAF or KRAS mutant colorectal cancer, cetuximab or panitumumab would actually have a survival detriment. It hurts patients. But in the presence of a MAP kinase inhibitor, that's when you see the benefit. And it's really goes back to the bench to bedside work that's been done that demonstrated EGFR feedback reactivation in the setting of a MAP kinase inhibitor.
All right. That's super helpful. That's great. Again, I'm learning so much. And then my other question, and we'll see if Manoj has any questions, is it sounds like we can already prescribe the FOLFOX combination in clinic frontline with the BRAF patient population. Are we going to be able to do the FOLFIRI soon? Is that already allowed? Or are we going to have to wait for insurance approval with a new FDA or NCCN indication?
That's a great question. You can definitely order FOLFOX with encorafenib, cetuximab, or panitumumab. You know, we just make a note of that. In the Southeast, we have a lot of issues with cetuximab reactions, so you can absolutely use panitumumab. I have ordered that for patients already and had no issue. I think that you could probably make an attempt to get FOLFIRI if you thought that was the best decision for your patient. You could think of a lot of different scenarios where you might want to avoid oxaliplatin. Maybe they'd already had 6 months of adjuvant oxaliplatin. You don't want to go back there. Maybe they have baseline neuropathy from some other condition. But I think you could try.
But we're expecting an approval, right? That in theory, yes. Okay.
And it's really those patients that Meredith just mentioned that it really matters for. Patients with baseline neuropathy that have a contraindication to oxaliplatin, this represents a reasonable alternative that, at least from small numbers and not as long a follow-up, but looking at early data, looks similar to FOLFOX combination and is going to give us, hopefully, similar outcomes without the neuropathy.
It seems like we've actually shifted the treatment paradigm, right? So historically, it's been FOLFOX, Avastin as kind of like maintenance therapy. And then now you're kind of shifting it to targeted therapy more so. You know, about 10 years ago, I think like sidedness became a big issue, right? In terms of saying right-sided versus left-sided colon cancer. Does that make any difference here, or is it strictly just based on just the alteration of BRAF? And if it is there, everything else kind of doesn't really matter as much.
The sidedness does not impact this decision. If you have a BRAF V600E patient, this is applicable left or right sided. But you do make a really great point, Manoj, in that knowing patients' biomarkers, which you could include sidedness in that, is really, really important for the frontline decision for a newly diagnosed colorectal cancer patient. I actually have shifted the way I talk to these patients from everybody coming in and saying, you know, you're probably going to get FOLFOX Bev if you're right-sided. If you're left-sided, I'm going to wait for your RAS status to come back to know if I can give you Bev or an anti-EGFR. But now we have enough targeted options, and especially if you also have access to frontline trials. I'm meeting the patient and saying, you know, probably you're going to get chemotherapy, but hey, you might have a target that we can alter your regimen based upon. Let's do a liquid biopsy. Let's meet again in a week, and then let's make our final decision at that point. And because you really need to know, of course, your MSI status, which thankfully we typically have that when we meet patients, but you also need your RAS status, your BRAF status, and then the sidedness really becomes important for those RAS and BRAF wild type patients, where you are, if you are left-sided, you have the option of frontline anti-EGFR in addition to chemo.
And Meredith highlighted that colorectal cancer is not one disease. It's many, many different diseases. And you really can't treat a colorectal cancer patient appropriately without having all of those biomarkers.
So let me ask you a question. I'm curious to see how both Jason, you and Meredith approach this. If you have a new colorectal cancer patient that's walking in, Meredith, you already alluded to this. If you have a new colorectal cancer patient walking into your clinic, and I'm a community oncologist that is seeing breast cancer, prostate cancer, and then lung cancer, and now I'm seeing a colorectal cancer patient. How am I going to approach this? And then what should I be thinking about when I'm thinking about my first line therapy that I'm going to prescribe to this patient?
So you're really, you know, as Jason mentioned, so many different subtypes within this disease, and your biomarkers are crucial. So for me, the first thing I think about is MSI. You know, are we MSI high? Are we deficient MMR? And if so, immunotherapy options. And we'll talk about that a little later. And then but of course, the vast majority of our patients are going to be microsatellite stable, then we're really looking at the presence of those different biomarkers to help us decide what biologic are we going to add to our chemo backbone.
And remind me, what biologic with what marker?
Sure thing. So if we're BRAF, then encorafenib and an anti-EGFR. If the patient is RAS mutated, then you would do bevacizumab or a trial. Because we are also seeing some RAS inhibitors coming into colorectal cancer treatment, including some frontline cohorts. And then if you have a left-sided tumor, then you're also looking at that RAS status. If the patient is RAS wild type, for reasons Jason said, in talking about the MAP kinase pathway, then you would add an anti-EGFR, so cetuximab or panitumumab.
Perfect. Okay, that does help. And I like to think the left-sided, right-sided, I'm like, why does this make any sense? But it does. I guess that's our version of upper track, lower track urothelial, maybe, right? To try to bring it into my brain to make sense of why that biology might be different. But you mentioned MSI high status. I'm curious to know what percent of patients are MSI high that are colorectal. And then I heard there was some new data at GI ASCO that was interesting about MSI high. Can you kind of fill us in on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So the frequency of MSI high is not huge, but it is very important to identify these patients because you make a really dramatic difference in treating them with immunotherapy versus chemotherapy. So as far as the new data, just to set the background, you know, we currently know that for MSI high or deficient MMR patients, they need immunotherapy. We have a lot of data on nivolumab, pembrolizumab, and then ipi in the combination of ipi-nivo. But at GI ASCO, a really interesting but small study called the COMMIT study was presented that showed results for the comparison of atezolizumab, anti-PD-L1, versus FOLFOX-BEV plus atezolizumab. And the reason that this is interesting is because we've always seen in the immunotherapy studies, there's a group of patients that has an early drop-off, right, suggesting that maybe there's rapid progression or something going on that, you know, could you impact with potentially a faster acting regimen? And so that was part of the idea behind this study, as well as preclinical work that suggests synergy between these agents. And so that was the setup for ATOMIC. As I mentioned, it was a for COMMIT. The other background information to know is that ATOMIC was presented at ASCO last year and established FOLFOX with atezo as an adjuvant option for stage 3 MSI high. So we already have some data on that. It did not include BEV. And so that led to the COMMIT study.
Let me ask you this follow-up question on the biomarker. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, Meredith. I was going to ask about HER2. Where does HER2 play a role in this entire paradigm of colorectal cancers and biomarkers?
I'm so glad you brought that up. That was a complete oversight that I did not mention HER2. HER2 should absolutely be checked on every colorectal cancer patient because we also have HER2 targeted therapies available primarily in later line at this point. As far as what's FDA approved, we have Enhertu and we have trastuzumab and tucatinib. There are ongoing studies looking similarly at bringing these targeted therapies in combination with chemotherapy early line. Right now, for standard of care decision, you don't have to have HER2 for your frontline treatment decision, but I think it's good practice just to go ahead and check it so that you have all of that data available to you to make treatment decisions for the patient throughout their journey.
And you're looking for IHC, I'm assuming?
Yes. So typical kind of IHC and then FISH.
And then, so going back to the MSI high, I think that was helpful, Manoj. You know, I've heard a lot like, oh, you got an MSI high. You're going to give this drug dostarlimab and have 100% cure rate in rectal cancer. They're going to give ipi-nivo or you're going to give pembro. We have these approvals that are kind of pan solid tumor FDA approvals. So with this data, and you know, we always talk about recording on Fridays at Oncology Decoded and going into clinic on Monday, but today is a Wednesday. So we're going into clinic on Thursday. Okay. I got an MSI high colorectal patient. What am I giving? Am I giving a pure immunotherapy strategy? Or with what you're saying, do I need to give a chemo IO strategy instead?
I think, I'll take this one. I think your initial decision tree comes down to how fast is a patient's disease progressing? And how, you know, what is their volume of disease? If you have someone maybe who is slower growing and has lower volume disease, you know, myself, I'm treating with single agent PD-1 for a majority of these patients based on prior data showing excellent response rates and still excellent overall survival improvements compared to chemotherapy. Like ultimately where COMMIT will fall in is for patients who may be progressing more rapidly and may have a higher disease burden. Like, personally, the way I approach COMMIT is it's intriguing. The complete response rate was almost doubled, but the 24-month overall survival data was exactly the same as single agent PD-1. You know, almost 10% of the patients on the chemotherapy combo arm had grade 5 events. Some of these were related to disease progression and other, but 10%, that doesn't sound like acceptable toxicity to me. So when I see a patient now and they may have bulkier disease that may be progressing more rapidly, my go-to is still doublet immunotherapy with ipi/nivo. I think an important distinction and reminder is we still don't have an OS readout that I'm aware of from doublet immunotherapy, and we don't have an OS readout from commit. So I think that answer will change. But as of now, I think for patients who have bulkier disease, I would be looking at starting doublet immunotherapy.
I completely agree with Jason. I think commit is very intriguing and thought-provoking, not practice changing yet. So I would not routinely offer a chemo PD-1 combo to a metastatic patient. I would, as Jason said, you know, for those high-risk patients, I would be thinking about ipi/nivo. But I do think there's more to learn to this in this story. I think, you know, there is likely some heterogeneity within the MSI high population. And are there some patients that we don't yet have the tools to properly identify that would really benefit from a chemo IO combo? Probably. But as far as standard practice, definitely not there yet.
Okay. So I'm struggling because I'm trying to make sense of this. And I understand the chemo IO versus IO. Maybe we need more mature overall survival, or maybe we need to wait. I get that. We have now an option, you're saying, between doublet immune therapy with a PD-1 CTLA-4 or single agent PD-1. And, you know, in clear cell kidney cancer, it's hard to imagine a patient that I would give PD-1 monotherapy to if I was going on a pure IO strategy. Now, sometimes I give an IO TKI. We've talked ad nauseum about that because we want to debulk. Same reasons you might give a chemo IO in an MSI high patient, it sounds like. Patients you're worried about that are going to have primary progressive disease and other things. But why would you choose a single agent PD-1 strategy over an ipi/nivo strategy in an MSI high patient if both of you are saying a higher volume of disease warrants doing that? Is that just because the toxicities are that substantial that you just get nervous about applying the ipilimumab? And I guess my question then is, another naive one, what dose of ipilimumab are you giving these patients?
Initially, if you think about this from a patient perspective, the only two things a patient cares about are how long do you live and how high a quality of life do you have, right? And so that gets down to a toxicity question. Ipi/nivo is more toxic than single agent PD-1. And so until you have definitively proven that there's a certain subset of patients who may benefit from doublet immunotherapy, it's hard to justify giving in absence of that data, knowing that a patient may have a harder time compared to single agent.
What's the dose of the ipi? Is it 1 or 3 mixed?
It's ipi/1. Ipi/1 for 4 induction doses and then nivo alone.
So it's the clear cell RCC regimen. And I think, you know, these are good points, but it's the exact opposite of what I hear in the kidney cancer world. We're waiting for 8Y8, which is going to do ipi/nivo versus nivo. And it still hadn't been published yet. But we're all using the immunotherapy doublets because we don't know, you know, some of these things. So I guess it's just the opposite biases and why we need to get out of our disease-specific silos sometimes to talk to other doctors. I mean, Manoj, what do you think? I'm crazy here? Am I over-eager to get an intensified therapy?
No. We've talked about this ad nauseum before. I think in GU we look at it very differently, and we are intensifying therapy, especially for those kidney cancer patients, right? So we if they have larger disease burden, if they're asymptomatic, we're giving them doublets, or we're giving them the higher dose of TKI in addition with that immunotherapy, right? So, and we know the toxicity profile is much harder, and but we're able to work our way through it. But it is interesting, but the similarities are also very interesting, right? We've talked about genomic sequencing at length in all of our talks that we've done in GU cancers. And one of the key takeaways that I got from this talk is genomic sequencing. Like, it's really, really important to understand whether it be for pancreatic cancer or whether it be for colorectal cancers, and whether it be solid, whether it be a liquid biopsy or a tissue biopsy, that sequencing parameter is getting more and more important in terms of figuring out how we're going to determine that first line therapy, regardless of what tumor type you're actually treating.
No, I think that's great. And I know we have to close soon. Are there any other tidbits of information from ASCO GI that we should know?
I think we hit the high points.
Okay. Anything else, Jason or Manoj? Okay, I'm seeing people shake their heads. It's an audio podcast, folks. So no, I'm just kidding. Anyways, I think that's great. Look, I think I agree with you, Manoj. What are the takeaways? Takeaways are getting all the information you can on a patient and sequence. I think it's challenging sometimes to make decisions between higher toxicity and lower toxicity regimens. And that's something that we'll just have to continue to evolve. I think the biggest takeaway for me outside of some of those nuggets on how to treat some of these patients in clinics is that we need to get together and have conversations with more folks outside of GU, because it's going to help me as a clinician learn more about how better to treat my patients in my disease state. So I think that was interesting. I think if you're listening, please follow us online on social media at X Oncology Decoded, or email us at oncology at, oh my gosh, I'm going to get it wrong.
Podcast at oncologydecoded.com.
See, when I don't have to.
It's only been a year.
Yeah. So there you go. That's Manoj to keep me honest the entire way through. So hopefully you enjoyed our India podcast. Hopefully you enjoyed our GI podcast. I think I'm enjoying them so much that we're going to be doing more of these. I can see Manoj is shaking his head yes. So we're going to be doing some outside of GU podcasts, more to come in 2026. But I do think the next podcast that comes on this feed is going to be a GU-related one as we kind of break down some of the stuff coming out of ASCO GU. So stay tuned for that. Me and Manoj will be in San Francisco, just like Jason and Meredith were in San Francisco for GI ASCO. We're headed to San Francisco for GU ASCO, and we'll be here to help break that down. So thank you all for listening, and have a good week.